with the cross in towards Alfonso Davies. Canada's history-making moment delivered by their biggest superstar. A goal the country has been dreaming about for decades finally arrives.
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Ben Steiner and Alexander Gonge-Rujic.
Hey there, folks, and welcome back into the Northern Football Podcast. It's episode 162 of Northern Football, and we're back a little bit quicker this time. We're looking at everything but the Canadian men's national team, pretty much, after our Canadian men's national team focus podcast earlier in the week, reviewing their Copa America qualification. Make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show wherever you get the podcast as well, as those are greatly appreciated. Ben Steiner, alongside Brendan Dunlop and Alex Gonge-Rujic, as usual. How are you guys doing? It's been an exciting week of Canadian soccer, even without the men's national team in the picture.
Oh, I've enjoyed just having a bit of a breather, boys. Didn't you feel like that? All of us, like, one, two stories a day, as opposed to having like eight things to write about, watch, and track. Like, we just knew that this roster was coming eventually. Thankfully, you know, other clubs were letting us know players that were on the team. But now the Canada's released the roster. We know the 23 players. We're good now, Alex.
Yeah, no, it's nice to kind of get in this little lull here in the week. You know, not a heavy schedule of Canadians playing this weekend. It was, you know, some good ones to tuck into, of course, but it feels like the stretch run's really about to begin on both sides. Like right now, I mean, we've seen it this week in the women's side. Their Champions League quarterfinals are wrapping up or right in the middle of that. That's, you know, all of a sudden it's semifinals. Whenever you reach the semifinals of any Champions League, that's usually a sign that the business end of the year is coming. And then, yeah, on the men's side, you know, they returned from an international break. We got some juicy Champions League ties there too. Like, I was looking at the championship, all of a sudden just eight games left. Of all leagues to look at, I know the championship, but it was just on my FUTMob yesterday. Like, there's some good, you know, feels like some good European football is coming to an end. But over here, closer to the pond, where the NWSL is coming back, MLS is in full swing, you know, CPL all of a sudden is on our horizon. I'm starting having to plan, you know, what games I'm going to, what the schedule is going to look like. It's that nice transition period where we go from all these just million morning games to afternoon and evening games, which I love with the sunshine.
I do also like that at this point we know when national team rosters are coming out, because I remember it used to be such a chaotic, you'd have your Twitter alerts on, clubs would be leaking stuff, you'd wait for insiders who don't usually report on Canadian soccer to break various elements of the roster, and it was just always a mess to figure out like when the national team rosters were coming out. Now we know that it's going to be, you know, 9 a.m. Pacific time it's going to come out, or sometimes 6 a.m. Pacific time it's going to come out, and then you can sort of sort out from there. With there's always a media availability, whether it's youth national teams or the senior national teams, there's just a lot more clarity on that too, and so you're not just like refreshing Twitter all day trying to see when that roster is coming out.
Yeah, I would say that's still annoying that the U.S. and Brazil name their squads, and then the next day Sporting tell us that Olivia Smith has made Canada's team, and yet we still have to wait. It was like 10 hours before we found out that there would be a press conference, meaning that today the squad was coming out. So yeah, there's a bit more structure, but in terms of trying to plan your day around things, it can be hard, but not griping about our side of the business.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing is I'm torn. Would you rather have it a TV release like the US and other nations sometimes? I think they do this in Brazil as well, where they like, it's a show. I'm kind of thinking about that. Like, I feel like it'd be cool, but I feel like the novelty would quickly wear off. It's like, oh, we're sitting in front of the telly for a friendly drop for friendlies against, you know, this and that. And you're like, oh, I don't know.
It works in countries like Brazil where you have like 35 TV channels, not here where you have 200. And there's just splintered attention. I like it for the World Cup. Like TSN did a great show for the men's World Cup release. And I think, again, for the women's World Cup, I think they did the same model show. So I like that for big tournaments. You can't do it for everyone. I mean, the W Gold Cup was 5 weeks ago. And now She Believes, you can't just stack them, sadly. The appetite isn't there, I don't think.
We see it with Brazil, right? It also means something when, like, Douglas Luiz gets called. You see that as a Villa fan, right? When he was crying, he makes the Brazil squad. I don't think we'd have the same reaction for some of the Canadian call-ups, I imagine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love that you went Douglas Luiz as opposed to David Luiz, to go back to my Benfica story from the other week.
I spared you. Went for a club of love of yours.
Well, the Canadian roster and player pool is just not big enough either, that everything's pretty expected. Like that roster drop this morning, and we'll get into it. There's not really any surprises in that. You know, you're not talking any dual nationals. You're not talking any young call-ups this time. Sometimes you do get a young call-up, but at least for the three of us, it's generally players that have either been in the youth systems or you've heard of. It's not necessarily sort of a exciting call-up. It's more like a matter of time call-up a lot of the time. And I guess we'll jump into that roster as well. Of course, it's for the 2024 She Believes Cup. Still 23 players, and it does mark some exciting returns to the national team, albeit not so surprising. Desiree Scott and Janine Becky back into the fold, replacing Mary Yasmin Aladu and Nichelle Prince, with Prince as well as Jade Revere and Sydney Collins all missing due to injury. And when you look at this roster, pretty well expected, but nice to see Janine Becky and Desiree Scott back in the fold.
Yeah, I think we expected to see Becky back. I mean, seems like she's back to almost full fitness, scoring and setting up goals at Portland. Desiree Scott, to me, is a bit of a surprise, but I think that this is that tournament where, you know, in taking a spot away from somebody else, you're giving Desiree Scott like her due, and you're giving her a full look and a full assessment, which is, you know, what Bev owes all of her players, but certainly someone like Desiree Scott. So I think there's a very good chance Marie Yasmin Aladu is on the Olympic squad, albeit that it would require some important pieces in front of her, higher up the pecking order at the moment, not being available. But in terms of, you know, which player do you think you'd be ready to put on the plane now? I think Bev knows that what she's got with Aladu, she doesn't know with Scott. So you got to see Scott, and this is a good setup.
Well, the question is, does she know what she has with Aladu? Because, I mean, we've hardly seen her in the field. And
no, fair.
The same way with, like Benfica, like obviously she's been in a lot of camps and there's a lot of value to it. But again, I feel like I'd love to see more of Aladu. She played one game at the Gold Cup, but she looked great in those minutes and we didn't see anything else. It was the debut match. She comes off, she finally gets to play up front. I am a bit surprised, but I think this is, you know, it's not surprising because I think one of Bev Priestman's strengths is the familiarity with the group. And I think the fact that she's willing to stick with a few players that aren't necessarily in form, or, you know, maybe coming off injuries, like for example Becky, this is a no-brainer in this squad. I think that's, she kind of made that clear in her first two games back, like scores a brace, and even this weekend a little quieter, but still some good moments. Like it's Janine Becky, she's a key part of this team. Ditto with Desiree Scott. We've mentioned how light Canada are in midfield, and that's, you know, that's the tough part for Aladu. That if she was still playing eight as she was before, I think she's in the squad easily because Canada needs depth there. You look up front, it's so deep. At the same time, you look at someone like a Deanne Rose, who just continues to struggle to find the level she was pre-injury with Reading. And, you know, Leicester, it's been in spurts. She's had some great runs of form for Leicester, but then she's gone really quiet, whereas Aladu just feels like every week she's finding the net. She's doing so at the Champions League too, so you can't be like, oh, you know, maybe the Portuguese league isn't good as the English league. Well, Aladu's out here scoring goals against Barcelona, against Lyon, who's of the game, that should count for something. It is a bit surprising that Aladu can at least earn a look in, say, just over a Rose, as off the top of my head, as someone who, you know, maybe hasn't been in the top of form that she can be. There are some other forwards too as well where you'd love to see an Aladu in. And but at the same time, that's Priestman's strength, right? She knows the squad, she's familiar with the squad. There's a few players where she kind of mentioned, like 13, 14 of her squad, she wants to be in form playing 90 minutes, but she hinted that maybe at the bottom of her Olympic roster, she wants some mercenaries. And that's where it could be tough to leave a Deanne Rose out, because even if she hasn't been at her best lately, we know what she can bring at her best. She can, you know, she can stretch defenses. She can have a great goal in her. She can be creative. And I think Aladu could have similar attributes and should earn a look, but obviously we've seen Priestman go for familiarity here.
The familiarity, as well as just the aspect of who's going to make this Olympic roster and how can you give a look at the players that are potentially able to make that Olympic roster? Because even though Aladu hasn't gotten that opportunity in match time for the Canadian women's national team, when you look at the picture of the 18 and you look at the starting 11, she's not cracking that starting 11. And there's a debate whether she's in that 18 or not, even on form, even, you know, given the form that she's shown in Europe this season, that if you're not considering her as part of that, you know, 14 players that are going to play likely every game at the Olympics, then is it worthwhile getting a look at someone like a Desiree Scott to see where they're really at this point in a tournament like this? And so I think a tournament like this in an Olympic year is very different than a tournament like this last year, per se. And I know last year was tied up with all of the legal attributes, and that was a complete distraction. But it is a different look, just because Alidou might not be even close to that Olympic 18 in Bev Priestman's mind.
Yeah, that's a good point. I realize it might sound like I contradicted myself when I said I think Bev knows what she's got with Alidou. Obviously, she's spoken about not having the time to assess her in a forward position, which is now playing for Benfica, scoring goals. And for Canada, she's always played in the midfield. Both of those departments in the Canada squad are very deep, and she just doesn't crack right now. Where does she fit? But in terms of like coverage, and as you said, the Gold Cup, you know, in the minutes that she did play in that one game, like, she looked good. She looks like she is where Lacasse and Vienne were just after the World Cup, where it's like, look at these players, like, they've got skill, they've got talent, they're knocking on the door, like, are they just going to get a chance? And you know, there's been some departures that have allowed those players to take more significant roles. And Alidou's just kind of in that spot behind them. She just happens to be 29. So she probably doesn't have the runway, doesn't have the time that Vienna Lacasse did to, you know, find her place. So she's battling. She, to me, that's a talent that you want to have to be able to turn to if you need. If Heidem is not scoring goals, like, wouldn't you want to throw Alidou up there or give her a crack? It's just hard with 18 players. That's obviously the dilemma that Bev's dealing with. But with a 23 here now, I think you need the time to fully assess Desiree Scott to either make up your mind if you're best Bev Priestman, whether you're still considering her for Paris, because it's going to be a headache and it's going to weigh a lot, right?
Well, even to the Alidou point with the age, Chloe Lacasse is about to turn 31 in July. And, you know, it's, we saw how long it's taken for her to battle, and she's showing that she can have a bit of a late resurgence. So why not Alidou, right? Like, it's funny how it's eerily similar, how Lacasse just tore up the Portuguese league for 4 years, and every year we're like, maybe give Lacasse a chance. She's scoring goals for fun. And then, you know, to add to it, she goes out and finally gets the chance, looks good. And you're like, well, you know, it shows you that sometimes that form, when you're like, yeah, okay, maybe again, the Portuguese league isn't the English league or the French league or the Spanish league, but when you're tearing it up to that level, like Alidou, 25 goals, 3 assists, you know, you just watch her too. Like, she's just, so her movement, the way she's finding space, the way she's making runs in the box, but she's also covers a lot of ground. She's playing as a 9 for Benfica, but sometimes she just drops into midfield, is covering for her teammates just all over the pitch. And you see the performances, and again, you see the goals against high level teams. It is, I think it's something where I feel a bit mixed on it, because I especially understand with Canada that chemistry has always been a big factor with this team, because they've always been a bit of a smaller pool. So sometimes they've always had to kind of stick together, whether they're playing, whether they're not. But I think as you're transitioning to being a bigger national team with a bigger pool like Canada is, and that pool's only going to explode when Project 8 comes around, because we're already seeing it kind of explode on the fringes of it with all these youngsters coming through, like Amanda West at the NWSL draft. You know, you look at Zoe Burns, how Simi Awuju, Olivia Smith have broken in.
Sydney Collins, who was like on no one's radar before being drafted.
Exactly, Sydney Collins, right? And I think with all these players going out now, I think what's going to be key in that next step, and I think it can wait for the Olympics, because like you mentioned, maybe familiarity is what you need for the Olympics. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to see more of that competition, because that's big national teams, right? If you're player number 21 on the roster and you're not playing and you're, say, at Spain, there'll be 20 players ready to step in and slot in. I think for Canada, okay, maybe you don't have 20 players ready to step in if you're struggling, but now they're starting to be 5-10. Soon they'll be 15-20. I would like to see that, because I do feel for Alidou, because like, what kind of message does that send where you've scored 25 goals in a debut season and 9 of them have been in the Champions League, 5 of them have been against Lyon, Barcelona, and you still can't crack the squad? I feel like that's a tough message to send. And that's, again, I think if there is a, I think of the like competition aspect of it, if players are getting rewarded for that sort of form, it's going to push other players. And they're like, oh, okay, if I go to this league and tear it up, say, the way Olivia Smith has done with Sporting, because that's an example of it on the other side of Smith has turned it up for Sporting. She's earned her chance. Why is it for Alidou? Yeah, she's a little bit older, but if she's one of your most informed forwards, give her a look. So I think that competition will only spread around the pool. Because we've seen on the men's side, right? Like Kyle Larin, Jonathan David scoring for fun. All of a sudden, Theo Bear, Ike Ugbo, Jason Russell Rowe have all been on their tails. Similar on the women's side with all this forward depth that they have. You got to find a way to kind of reward those who are informed, but maybe that's a project for after the Olympics.
The interesting thing I find with the Canadian forward depth on the women's national team is just the different tactical looks that basically every forward offers. And that's something that Mary's Yasmin Alidou also offers in a different light as well, because as you said, the way that she's able to drop and the amount of miles that she puts on her legs every single game is a little bit different than most of the players on the current roster that were named today. And having that sort of transitional piece to drop in from the attack and then play off a midfielder and then make a run into the box, that's a piece that Canada doesn't necessarily have within the group as it stands. But then there's also the question that you can jump into from at April Sets, and how does she integrate herself into the group if she's not getting called up, and how can she get within that chemistry?
That's a million-dollar question. I mean, how many more goals does she need to score in Portugal? And what does it say about the Portuguese league? Like, what I wanted to ask when Alex was waxing there about it, it's like, is the Portuguese league in the women's game the equivalent to the Dutch league in the men's game? We say, well, this guy scored 35 goals in Holland, but hey, it's Holland. Is he going to do it in the Premier League? Does he have to do it in two more seasons in Holland before he gets a look? Like, it kind of feels like that's what Portugal is. I think Alidou, you know, it's unfortunate. She's like, with the timing, she's just kind of the victim of there's a slew of forwards that are super dynamic as opposed to being simpler pieces to put, you know, into the puzzle, a traditional number nine, traditional winger. And you really only have kind of like two forwards that you would say slot into a traditional form, in my opinion, Heidema and Leon. And then with Vienne, with Lacasse, with Alidou, with Smith, it's incredible that there's so much dynamism with these players, but it's almost too much. It makes it hard to adjust. I guess from like an American football perspective, it's like we can tell how incredible some of these super athletic quarterbacks are, like Lamar Jackson, but he just simply doesn't work for 31 teams, 31 of the other teams in the NFL, right? There's a lot that's required to work with players that can be that dynamic. And in Canada's case, when you have so many players, yes, it's a great luxury to have, but it's almost like it's too much now. It would be easier if she was just a one trick pony, almost, to be honest. If she was just a number nine, if like she doesn't have the height, but let's say she was aerially outstanding, then I think she has a better chance.
Well, it's interesting because I think this is the perfect time for Alidou to come in, funnily enough, because we kind of talk about her profile as a nine, right? Like, maybe a bit more of a false nine. She's very good at combining, dropping deep, covering ground. And then her skills, these late runs, like watch so many of her goals for Benfica. She just makes these late runs. She's not the tallest. She scores so many headers, which again is a testament to her positioning, these late run one touch finishes. And then for fun, she mixes in some bangers. This camp, who is missing due to an injury, Nichelle Prince. What has Nichelle Prince's big asset been as a number nine for Canada? Hasn't necessarily always been the goals. It's because, let's be real, between Prince, Heudema, and Vien, Prince has been the most capable hold-up option. She's been the most capable at combining with Adriana Leon and Chloe Lacasse, at dropping, making these late runs into the box and scoring goals. Would it not make sense to at least bring Alidou and try her in that Prince role with Prince out injured? I think there's no better time, because I think, to your point, Brennan, about how, you know, Alidou's not getting much of a look because so much of what's around her. Well, it feels like of the profiles in the front line, Prince is the one she's most directly linked to, and Prince isn't here. And that's another surprise, where it's like, you bring Janine Becky in, which again, she deserves it. How many wingers are in the squad? You got Lacasse, you got Leon, you got Becky, you got Larissa, you got Smith. Like, you know, where are some of the minutes going to go around there? I mean, now at the nine, you got Vien and Heudema. That's still a lot too. But again, as we've seen, Heudema and Vien fit in two very different ways. Give Alidou a shot in the Prince role, because again, with Prince having dealt with the Achilles injury, we still don't know the state of this calf injury. I can't imagine it's too serious, but you know, we'll see what happens, because obviously Prince has battled injuries. No better time than now to at least look at Alidou, because say it comes down to an Olympic squad and you're talking about profiles and you're trying to, because that's the big thing with Prince. Like, is she on paper Canada's best number nine option, just in terms of what they bring as a table, you can argue it's Vian Hoytema, but Prince fits the best in that front three. If I'm picking a starting 11, it's Lacasse, it's Prince, it's Leon. Why not give Alidou that chance too? So that's another area where even if we talk about profiles, it also doesn't quite add up. And again, a lot of nuance, of course, in this Alidou discourse. We've spent about 15 minutes on it, but no, it shows how strange it is that she isn't called. Because even again, with Prince not there, it feels like this is the moment.
Canada, of course, getting a match against Brazil to start off the She Believes Cup, and then it'll either be the United States or Japan. And Alex, you and I were talking yesterday that it should be the U.S. because then they would hopefully get the game that they deserved at the Gold Cup.
And hopefully it's a final, at least at the very least. Yeah, if you win the She Believes Cup, it's a trophy. It's nothing of significance. It's a friendly trophy. But hey, at least for Canada, it'll mean a little more. Be like, oh, that U.S. team, if you're Canada, the way you were playing, exit the group stages at the Gold Cup, top seed, you know, no goals conceded. Yeah, you're the top dogs. You're the favorites heading into the knockout rounds. And the U.S. who ends up winning beats you on a day where the pitch conditions were absolutely deplorable. As you know, they should use this as a bit of a revenge for, yeah, they stole our Gold Cup trophy. Let's go out and take She Believes Cup in their own backyard. Let's beat Brazil. Let's get a final with the U.S. I think this would be a good chance for Canada to, you know, really a game to make up for what they lost in that semifinal. So I'd be 100% hoping for U.S.
Yeah, me too. I think the room is as well. I was thinking about this Canada-U.S. women's rivalry while watching Mexico and the United States the other night in the Nations League final, and how, you know, the U.S. men's national team has really turned the tide on Mexico, and Mexico is afraid to play against them. Forever, Mexico were the kings. The U.S. couldn't hold a candle. Then, you know, the U.S. women's team has an incredible record against Canada, but we've seen the gap closing. We've seen, you know, the depth that Canada has now. The She Believes Cup may be, you know, it's not a continental real tournament. It's a preparation tournament. But in terms of like trophies and in terms of cementing that rivalry or closing that gap, like this is definitely Canada's chance. And I think they should look at that final if they meet up with the U.S. in this She Believes Cup final. They should look at it like a Nations League final. They should look at it like a W Gold Cup final and go out there and treat it as that. And then the future of this rivalry between the two programs, and especially the U.S. program that's very much in transition. Like, I think Canada could overtake that in the next Olympic cycle, World Cup cycle. I really do.
I mean, when you look back 8 years ago at when Canada used to compete at the Algarve Cup, that win, I think it was against Brazil in a final, really marked the start of that generation for the Canadian women's national team. And then they go on to the Olympic success. So these tournaments, these friendly tournaments, these friendly trophies, they don't matter as much as, you know, a Nations League, a Gold Cup, and those elements that have come to the women's game now, but they still matter. And I think winning a trophy could be a massive boost, even if it is a friendly trophy that's organized by the U.S. Soccer Federation.
No, there's immense value in these sorts of games, right? Yeah, even if it's a friendly, but something, again, it's Canada-US. At the end of the day, Canada's won four times over the US. It would be a massive morale booster to win for a fifth time in a final, albeit a She Believes Cup final. It's still a final. You still get a trophy, even if it's a friendly tournament. That sort of stuff could really rally a Canadian team before the Olympics. And yeah, I think it's something where it definitely feels like with the U.S. in transition between, you know, eras, the double World Cup winning team and now a younger generation. I think if you're Canada, at least this would be a good time to kind of set a bit of a psychological message, because with the Rapinoe, Carly Lloyd, you know, Julie Ertz team, that team wasn't scared of Canada. They always kind of ran over Canada. You kind of, like, remember when Canada finally beat them at the Olympics in 2021, Megan Rapinoe was like, what is this? We're not supposed to lose to Canada. Like, yeah, we'll lose to anyone else. We're not supposed to lose to Canada. With this transition to a lot younger U.S. team, look, this U.S. team still very deep on paper. Like, some of the names they're leaving home, it's going to be tough for Canada to compete with it. But sometimes in a rivalry, you just need a bit of a psychological hurdle. And I think this U.S. team saw Canada like, oh, in this mud bath game, they gave us a run right to the end. And had they been better at penalties, we easily could have lost that game. Just Alyssa Nahar had the PK game of her life. Canada struggled with PKs, strangely, considering how they won the Olympics. you're Canada, this could be a game where you go out and, you know, again, you win it. Maybe it sets a bit of a psychological message to some of these younger Americans that all of a sudden they're not, you know, entering their primes. Like, oh, we always beat Canada, playing Canada. Oh, it's going to be great to play Canada. No, they're like, oh, this Canadian team under Bev Priestman and with this younger group, like players like Olivia Smith, Simi Wujo, Jade Rose, we don't like playing them. Like they play us tough. They try to stretch the field. They play this annoying 3-4-2-1. Again, that's the sort of message that you could set where, again, this U.S. team goes and wins again. You're just kind of like stuck in the same cycle or, yeah, heading into the Olympics. That's going to be, because, again, we have to remember that it's a very strong chance they play each other at the Olympics with how small the tournament is. This is a kind of chance to kind of get a punch in now so that heading into that match, you're in a good place psychologically.
100%. Last thing I want to say on this is that I'm glad that this year they can go into this tournament and know that they're focusing on Olympic preparation. Last year was needed. Don't get me wrong. Last year was important for all the off-field stuff. It's unfortunate that it went the way it was, and it was the mental drain that it was. Janine Becky's spoken about this and how, you know, she has to take a step back and mentally she has to focus on her body and her game, and that's what this will be. This is all about the football, this tournament. I think that's – I'm very excited to see that, to have Canada go into this tournament and just focus on that, to dream about getting a revenge game, to get good conditions to play the U.S. in the final, and work on the things that they want to work on that they simply didn't get to last year before the World Cup. So I hope, you know, in that regard, this is just, we're talking about a ton of positives instead of all the off-field negatives that we did last time.
And we're also only about a year away from Project 8 starting, and there's still a lot of work to do in terms of announcing the teams. There's nowhere near the full-fledged of teams, but there is a new team brewing in Halifax, it looks like, with Atlantic Women's FC. The branding, the official name, is not out there yet. There's some sort of filler branding that initially I thought was real that was a little bit unnerving, but the question from WSoccerCA is, what do you guys think of Project 8 in Halifax? And also, if you could build a soccer-specific stadium, not necessarily just for a women's national team, anywhere in Canada, where would you put it? Rumor has it that Hokelani Limited is interested in building the stadium. And they're, of course, a group that's potentially interested in Project 8 as well.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's great. This is kind of, again, a market you'd love to see. They've obviously, again, markets like Halifax will always say for pro soccer in general. We've spoken at it at length in the CPL. Just look at the way they've embraced that market where it's that mix of a market like Halifax, which is big enough to constantly put 6, 10, 15, maybe even 20,000 in seats. It's a big market. Having been there, you can see it's definitely a, you know, it's not a Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto size, but it's a big city. But also the only other pro team in Halifax and the Wanderers is the Thunderbirds. It's lacrosse. Other than that, it's junior hockey, which they support very well to their credit. It's a perfect place to drop in a Project 8 team. They've shown they love their soccer. I have to imagine that they'll extend to the women's side as it should. They just look at the excitement when the Wanderers announced their involvement in League One Atlantic with the Wanderers women's team. So I'm very excited for this. What I'm going to be very curious about, of course, is where the collaboration is like with the Wanderers, because I feel like there could be a lot of potential for both clubs to work hand in hand and really just capitalize on the soccer boom in the city. And because I have no doubt in my mind that a women's team would be very well supported in Halifax. I think they would, you know, they would show up, especially if it's competitive. And I think this is the exact sort of market they should target. I think some of the names I threw out, I think was last year when the, or even I guess 2 years ago now when Project 8 was first announced, was like, you need some places like a Moncton or a Halifax, you know, then you go into the middle. There's definitely some teams in the prairies that you'd love to get a look at. I think this is a good spot. And we learned a lot of news in that release, right? That there's going to be 6 inaugural teams in year one. So all of a sudden that gives us an idea of what's still more to expect. But I think Halifax is a great market. It has, as it's shown for the CPL, and excited to see where things go from here, such as a collaboration.
The concern I have about Halifax, and it might not be warranted in soccer, but from my experience covering a lot of Atlantic Canadian sports in the university realm, is the support for women's sports is not there to a similar level at all to the passion for the men's sports. Because when you look at, and I know it's not not soccer, but if you look at hockey, the attendances for men's U sports hockey is immensely different than the attendances for women's esports hockey in the Atlantic University Conference. And that can go across conferences. The most stark difference is definitely at the University of New Brunswick, where they sell out games for the men's team and they barely touch 1,000 fans for the women's team, which also won their conference championship. So that's my only concern with Halifax, is maybe for a regular season team, that passion isn't necessarily there for women's sports, because I've just noticed in my travels out there, in my experience within the university realm, that it's just not the same. But I'm hoping I'm proven wrong. I'm hoping that assumption is not right. And given the passion surrounding women's soccer so far that we've seen on social media and such, and the turnout at the women's national team game, I'm hoping that doesn't translate to soccer, but it's definitely a concern I have.
Well, they don't have the major market sports that other Canadian cities do, and they're not of that size. I think that the sports interest in the East Coast, from my experience, is just very splintered, right? So even in the case of it being the same sport, men's hockey, women's hockey, it is two different kind of sets of fans. It doesn't necessarily translate to both sets of fans. I think for women's soccer specifically, to me, the sign that, oh, Halifax definitely needs to be a place, is that A, Canada Soccer felt of this Christine Sinclair farewell tour, we're going to do a game in Halifax. And it was so well received, despite the weather being awful that night. And everyone seemed, you know, very happy, regardless of the fact they're playing in a temporary stadium, that it's, you know, you could have put that game in probably four or five other Canadian cities. Wild that there wasn't a farewell game in Toronto for Christine Sinclair. But to me, Halifax seems like a place that's ready for that. They've shown it with the men's soccer. And I think that there's an opportunity for there to be some type of partnership, simply because soccer, I think, is a untapped market there, or a lesser tapped market than some of the other sports before, where you've allowed that splintering of attention, as I was describing, to like kind of set in. Like, there's just more history with basketball, with hockey, both men's and women's in the East Coast. And with soccer, they haven't had like one thing to kind of unify around. They have that with Wanderers now, and they'll have that with this Project 8 team. I think it'd be great if there was a real partnership for the two of them to drive it forward and make it kind of one cause, and not end up in the women's team versus men's team side of things. Like, do it as one, you know, rising tide to raise all boats type thing. I think that there's a huge opportunity for success in Halifax for a Project 8 program.
It'll be different too, I think, because it's one club, right? It's not, you know, it's this Halifax Project 8 team. It's one, you know, it's one team trying to sell itself. And sometimes in, like, say, in the university sports example, there's a splintering because it's under one umbrella. Like you mentioned, UNB men's and women's hockey, but it's two very, you know, different things. Attention's very divided. Maybe marketing might push first one versus the other. You know, I say just this year, as a very casual observer, I saw a lot more UNB men's hockey just swirling around in my timeline and in Twitter and everything like that versus the UNB women's hockey team. I couldn't tell you anything about how they did, but the men's team was all over pushing. Of course, they had a historic season. I think it'll also be different that in this case, it's, you know, the Halifax women's team, as if it is this a separate entity from the Wanderers, which it appears to be, they'll be putting all their effort in making sure that the marketing, the push to get certain audiences out, they'll be putting 100% of that. And then, yeah, really the bigger question is, yeah, like we mentioned, will they work together so that they can also help each other? But I have no doubt that at the very least, by doing their own project, they're really going to be pushing to make sure that attention doesn't get splintered, as it can sometimes be when you're a university program and you only have so much attention to push into things. I mean, having been to universities myself, you notice that stuff's always just naturally splintered, right? Like when we're going to TMU, some years you hear a bit more about the men's hockey team, some years you hear a bit more about women's basketball, some years you hear a bit more about men's basketball. Like, it really depends on the year. Whereas in this professional sport environment, will there be clubs putting all their marketing focus behind one thing? I think that'll kind of overcome that problem.
You mentioned the splintering, and on that thought, would there be an issue with the Wanderers opening up their women's side of things, albeit in League One, and then hopefully looking at one day at Project 8? Is there going to be a, you know, people throwing bricks at each other instead of laying bricks with each other with women's soccer in Halifax?
it's Canada soccer, right? The sad reality is it seems like you're just as prone to be throwing bricks as, yeah, probably more prone than laying them. I would hope not. I understand from a business perspective why the Wanderers would want to be involved in women's soccer, and maybe it's not the right opportunity for them to have started a Project 18, but yeah, I don't know. I guess that'll have to play itself out. I really hope that it's not another Canadian soccer story where they're throwing bricks at each other, because we just can't afford that anymore.
I'd say there's a path, right? I think if Wanderers are doing League One, Halifax is doing Project 8 on the other side, why not just start, be a pipeline, right? Like, we've seen a lot of League One to pro pipeline. Immediately, that could be something where they support each other, where some of those Wanderers players who are developing in League One, they have a path to go across the street, so to speak, and go make it pro and get looks on the roster. And then from there, long-term, if the Wanderers feel like they could go in the pro game, maybe that's something where, again, it's some sort of, they come together and they figure out a solution where they keep one team or the other, they amalgamate. Cause I think that would be a good place to start and go from there, right? I think that would be some sort of solution. Who knows? Maybe it's something where that Halifax ownership group, this is, again, we'll have to see how things develop, but maybe there's a scenario where the Project 8 ownership group, the Wanderers take them over, and then that Project 8 group, having had hopefully what we hope is the first 4 or 5 successful years, maybe they take their talents to Moncton and build a Project 8 team there. Maybe they go to a different market. And that, I'd like to see some proactive solutions like that where, yeah, like we mentioned, it's not just punching each other in the face because they're all in the same territory. Find some sort of solution that starts as a partnership now, and maybe it leads to something down the road that benefits the league as a whole. I think that's what we'll want. And of course, fans in the Halifax market will love to be able to support a team unconditionally, knowing that they're all supporting each other and building each other up.
And on the stadium question as well, the more we talk about it, a 6,000 to 15,000 person stadium, I think, would be perfect for Halifax, given the support there, at least for the Wanderers. I think they could have that stadium and fill it right now at 15K for some games. Other cities that I think could suit a 6 to 15K soccer-specific stadium, Edmonton, I think could be a good shout as well, if you sorted out the ownership issues with a potential CPL or Project 8 team there too.
Well, we need miles more stadiums. We really do. Like, we have a shortage of stadium infrastructure in this country. So I think it would be huge to get another 6 to 15K seater, because that feels kind of like the range that's missing. Like, yeah, there's a BC place that's massive. You've got a BMO field that's in a decent 30 to 40K. You've got a Stade Olympique that hopefully when it's rebuilt and they get some good, maybe they fix the turf, maybe that becomes viable. There is a lack of like Stade Saputo's, because I think Stade Saputo is the exact perfect blueprint for stadiums you need across the country. Grass, 19,000 seats. Like, oh, imagine a few more of those in like a prairies. Imagine one of those in Vancouver, Halifax. I think 100% building up that infrastructure would be massive, and something that's sorely missed, because yeah, we see with so many of the national team games, like if you're not playing a game at BC Place, BMO or Saputo or Olympic Stadium, where are you playing it these days? Like, yeah, it was great to have games at Wanderers ground, but in an ideal world, that's a permanent 15K stadium, and all of a sudden the national teams can visit there way more regularly.
I really liked the renderings for the Halifax Wanderers Stadium. Why it was going to come out to 40 million and not be a 20,000 seater, I don't know. But to me, the renderings reminded me of Stade Saputo, and I agree with you that I think that we need more of that. That should be the soccer aim. Maybe they're not all 20,000 seaters, but if you can build a model that looks like that, I think we should have a few of those in markets across the country.
And jumping into our MLS chat as well, TFC picked up a big 2-0 victory on the weekend over Atlanta. They bounced back after their first loss with goals from Tyree Spicer and Prince Owusu. And TFC, it's still working for them. Even though they took a bit of a hiccup, it's still working for John Herdman and Peter.
TFC, they keep doing it. They keep getting the job done. And I mean, look, these wins are going to count massively. Let's not pretend like it was Atlanta's best version of themselves. You know, unfortunately, you get a bit ravaged by the international break. They're missing basically their two main guns from the last few weeks in Giacomakis, who is on the bench for Greece as they push to make Euros. And then, of course, Thiago Almada wasn't there. So it was something where a bit tough for Atlanta in this. But look, TFC continues to rack up the wins, and they continue to look organized. New guys are stepping up. I think it's great that, you know, Tyree Spicer, first round overall pick, you heard a lot about, gets his chance to live up to that spicy tea nickname he's already earned, which I think is pretty hilarious. So credit to those who've been inspired by Pascal Siakam's name and transferring over that to Tyree Spicer. And yeah, again, I think what continues to be so impressive for me, at least, is the structure within which they're playing. That, again, to keep a clean sheet, to be so defensively sound, to kind of bounce back after a tough loss. And if they're going to continue to get timely goals like this from guys like Spicer, they're going to need that, because Insigne continues to battle injury issues. He's out with a hamstring issue. He only lasts 45 in this game. They're going to need guys to step up. And hey, maybe that's what the doctor ordered for Prince Owusu. We haven't been the kindest to him here on the podcast, as he struggled to start the year. But as we know, with strikers of all forms, they're so mercurial, one goal drops. If that can get them into any semblance of form, that would be massive, because the fact they've had this start without, again, continuing to struggle at that nine position, figuring out, DeAndre Kerr has had a good flash up there. An informed striker would go a long way, because the structure they continue to play with gives them chances every week. And last year with TFC, that wasn't always the case, especially later in the year as things started to fall apart.
We knew they were going to be better defensively. No one could have predicted that five games in, they'd have conceded the least amount of goals in the league. The fact that they've got four clean sheets and Luka Gavran had the gloves for two of them, like, it's wild. And he earned them. Like, he's been great. He's been a fantastic deputy. And who knows, if Sean Johnson continues to battle injuries, we could be talking about a Jonathan Siwa situation where Gavran takes the gloves full time come next season, right? Or towards the end of the season. But defensively, like, they've really got it. They haven't been, you know, we'll see what the situation is with Shane O'Neill. They haven't been as snake bitten, at least central defense. Obviously, Petretta's been out. Larea has been out. Those are, you know, absences I thought would have a much bigger impact on this back line. But they've been fortunate that the system has worked. Everyone seems to really have kind of bought into that. And it was nice in this last game against Atlanta to see goals come from other places. And if that continues, then TFC are going to keep surging. The MLS experts had them ranked 11th in the power rankings this week, which I found kind of funny, because both Vancouver and Montreal were ahead of them. Montreal didn't even play. Vancouver lost.
But, you know, what are the MLS power rankings at this point? They're just rage Twitter, bait Twitter fishing. The a little bit of insight onto the spicy tea shout for Tyree Spicer. TFC's social admin took a switch this year, and it's about three people, and one of the people actually used to be the second in hand for the Raptors social admin. So I wonder whether there was anything of that realm that he comes over to TFC, and he prefers soccer. I know him well, and he went to the TMU sport media program that Alex and I went to as well. But I wonder whether he was the guy that sent that tweet. And I know he's been the guy behind a lot of the refreshed memes look as well. His name's Emil Riga, and he certainly has cut his teeth at TMU and then cut his teeth with the Raptors as well. And now he's at TFC, the club that he grew up cheering for.
Very cool, man. Yeah, the I like the nickname, and admin's been great this year. You can tell that there's a bit of a shift that obviously helps that the team's winning. I think from top to bottom, the players are more excited, the staff's more excited, you know, more content's out there. Let's keep it going. I'm all about all for one, man. I've been on that since day one. I'm sad that they're not fixed 24-minute episodes anymore, but I'll take the snippets where I can get them, and they've been pretty good lately.
Yeah, certainly a lot of good things happening with TFC, and they take on Sporting Kansas City this weekend at BMO Field. We'll look at the Whitecaps as well, and they went up early. Demir Krylak, a good finish for his first MLS goal with the club, but they fall 2-1 to RSL, their former roommate, in effect. But a loss for the Whitecaps that they probably shouldn't have dropped, especially in the way that they did. And Alex, I know you and I yesterday were talking about that Takaoka probably could have put himself in a better position to make the save on the goal from Alexander Kotranas late in that game. But at the end of the day, it's a good strike, and that does the Whitecaps in with a 2-1 loss.
Yeah, it was just frustrating, because that game was 100% there for the Whitecaps. You go up 1-0. The thing is, they've been defending so well to start the year. So especially to go up 1-0, it's not like the Charlotte game where they were chasing, and they just kind of ended up having to settle. They're up 1-0. You're in control. But it was, yeah, it was just a bit of a lapse of 20 minutes where they just kind of sat a little deeper. And then what hurts is that the first goal really is what sunk them. And what hurts is that for them, they had a moment where it was, I think they just made a run of the box. Someone made a cutback. I think Demir Krylak made a dummy because he thought someone was behind him. It goes all the way out the box. And then RSL scored on that literal transition moment. And it was just a bunch of mistakes. Like this, the Whitecap CBs all dropped. And then, you know, they're supposed to defend a zone. When you're defending a zone, you're on the same line. Ranko Veselinovic inexplicably dropped like 4 feet behind his defensive line playing on Anderson Julio. And from there, it was a 1-1 game. And that was the big break, the big hit for the Whitecaps, because the momentum was already going against them. Brian White was already off the field, and that was a huge blow with the concussion, because he came off with a concussion-like symptoms. They made a concussion substitute to bring him off. Their attack was already struggling without them. I think they could have ground out a 1-0 win had they not allowed that goal, but from there, it was kind of like survival mode. And yeah, that's... the Whitecaps were kind of due a bit of a bad bounce, and for Katranas just to catch Takoka there, it's a tough one for the keeper, but it happens sometimes on crosses. You always naturally cheat because you don't expect for someone to shoot from there, and he got beat. And it was a frustrating one because the Whitecaps still defended well. Like they had the numbers were good. They allowed like 16 shots, but none of them were really of quality. But in the end, two mistakes really killed them. And that the big thing they'll have to figure out now is what's going on with their attack. Because last year, their attack was enough to maybe in a game like this, they still 2-2, 3-2. They continue to struggle, especially when Fafapiko is not up there. And that's a bit of a worry because when Fafapiko was signed, you didn't expect for him to be the heartbeat of this attack. But for whatever reason, having him out there just seems to bring the best out of White, Gold, and everyone else around them.
I think you can also take a look at Yohei Takaoka and how he positions himself in opportunities like the one that ended up in that goal that beat him. Because as a shorter goalkeeper, you have to adjust and not play in the same way that a guy who's 6'4 is going to play. And Takaoka is not the tallest goalkeeper. He has to adjust in the way that he approaches things. So even when a cross comes in like that, as you said, you have to cheat. You have to go out there and try and challenge for that cross. But it's a different approach than you would if you were a taller keeper. If you're a taller keeper, you can go out and grab crosses. You can go out and grab corner kicks and you can really challenge, but he plays sometimes as if he's a bigger keeper and he can go out to those opportunities. Whereas sometimes maybe he has to back off a little bit and focus on making the save. And I know that's something that as a shorter goalkeeper myself, when I was going through goalkeeper training, those were adjustments I had to make. And when I look at goalkeepers, you bring in one idea of what you're going to do. But when I was going up for corner kicks, and of course I'm immensely shorter than Takaoka, is I'm about 5'6". If I go up for a corner, I'm not going to get there. No matter how high I can jump, I'm not going to get my arms up to grab a ball. So I had to adjust to make the save. And a guy like Maxime Crépeau is able to make those saves as a shorter goalkeeper because of how athletic he is. And Takaoka, I think, still has to work on that adjustment. And maybe that's something that he didn't have in the J-League because he was one of the taller players in that league.
I've got this image of a young Ben, like, learning to defend on corners. And he's just, like, dead-legging guys, like, in the thigh. He's just, like, elbow in the lower back as the ball's coming in, right? Like, a tall defender or attackers must just hate you because they're like, I want to squash you, but I can't because I'm going to ruin this chance and be called for foul immediately.
Yeah, exactly. I had to adjust because I would get called for fouls, give up a penalty kick. And so I would have to adjust to just make the save on, let the chance come through, let my center back take care of it. And then if it comes through, I was on my line to make the save. And I just had to anticipate and cheat where the shot might go based on, you know, what I'd seen of the striker before. That it's not easy being a short goalkeeper. It's possible. But there's just so much anticipation that you've got to have. And that's something that the good short goalkeepers have. And that's something that Maxime Crépeau has that Takaoka still, I think, has to develop.
We're not calling Crépeau a short goalkeeper, though.
He's not a tall goalkeeper. He's not Courtois for any means.
No, but he's got to be my height or 6'1", even. No?
I think he's been listed. I don't know what it is now, but he's been listed at 5'11 in the past. 5'11, 6 foot. So that's it. He doesn't play small, though. That's the thing. No. You wouldn't notice. That's something that, because I've seen a funny thing I saw a few weeks ago is someone like, oh, Jonathan Sirois is too short. Sirois, I think, has 2 inches on Crépeau. Yeah, it's something It's a matter of perception. I think that's, again, that's the lesson for someone like a Takaoka, is how do you just play to your strengths for your size? Because you're always going to have advantages and disadvantages. If you're super tall, remember Thibaut Courtois back in the day for Chelsea, his big issue is that he couldn't save anything near his feet to save his life, probably because he was so tall that, you know, the distance the neurons had to travel between his brain and his feet to react weren't, took him a while to kind of learn about that whole process. Whereas as a shorter keeper, it's different advantages. But no, it's all little things for Takaoka. To be honest, I'm not too hard on him on that Katrina's goal, just because I think he's been otherwise very good this season. The only really other goal where he was a bit caught out was the one against Dallas, where it was just, that was a mix of poor set piece defending. It was a mix of a perfect ball from Dallas and poor set piece defending, and Takaoka maybe not being as aggressive. But yeah, I think it's something where those are the little things that Takaoka is going to have to continue to adjust, because you know MLS forwards are going to target it. They know what his strengths and weaknesses are, and it's going to be up for him as, you know, again, not a 6'4" imposing hunk of metal that's going to go out and claim everything, that he's going to have to be careful to pick his spots and to use his reflexes and to react. Because when he does, he's such a good just reactive shot stopper. He can make some great sequences of saves. There are some moments in this game where he was helping the Whitecaps keep their lead. And then, yeah, it's just one of those where as a goalie, it's tough, because I think, again, for me, the moment that really hurt them in the game was the Ranko Veselinovic, just his positioning on the first goal. But sometimes as a goalkeeper, to then go allow the goal as he did on the 2-1, that can hurt your team, right? It's a big momentum booster. It ends up hurting in 3 points, and that's a tough life as a goalkeeper. You might not be the reason the game turned on its head, but you allow a goal like that, it's easy to look at you and be like, well, you're the reason your team ended up losing all points on the day.
Goalkeepers have it rough, man. They're a different breed. But you're right, Max Crippo is listed on the Portland Timbers website as 5'11", which surprises me, because he seems like at least a 6 foot guy. Pantemis is only listed at 6'1", and I stood next to him on the plane coming back from Qatar, and I'm supposed to be 6 feet, like 5'11" and 5'8", and he looked taller than 6'1", Pantemis. So you never know what to believe with these height listings. Just look at the NBA. Also, Wikipedia, can we stop with meters? This is so annoying. I just want quick, boom, player's height. Oh, 1.88 meters. Jeez, what are we doing with meters?
Well, as the only single guy on this podcast, I can tell you that 5'11 certainly does mean 6 feet, and 5'6 really does mean 5'7".
That's the dating profile listing, buddy. Do you have to put your height on Hinge and Tinder? Is that
part of it? Oh, yeah. And you can set filters on it for, like, whether you want to, you know, see people who are of a certain height. Right. Right. And so there's a whole lot of people who, yeah, Mr. High School Sweetheart. But yeah, the 5'6", 5'7" is a bit of a, you know, gray line. And I know that 5'11 isn't a real height either. So, yeah, so there's definitely a gray line on height, not just on sporting profiles. But CF Montreal didn't have a match this week. They had a bye. They returned to action with a clash against DC United this week, their penultimate road game in a 6-game road swing before returning to Montreal for their home opener after that field defrosts. But it's not been a very cold winter in Quebec and Ontario, so they probably could have played a home match, but it's always going to be that long spell with an outdoor stadium in Quebec.
I feel like it's been good for them to, you know, obviously they've started well, but you always, you know, you bond differently when you're away, which is why they do camps as long as they do them. And then to start the season like they have with Courtois, who's a much refreshing new voice. And, you know, for some of those guys, a familiar voice, because I think he echoes a lot of the things that Wilfred Nancy implemented when he was there. It's been great. It's been fun to watch them. Honestly, last weekend, despite all the football that was going on, I was disappointed that we didn't get a look at Montreal. So to see them again this weekend will be good.
Six game road trips to start there, really, you can only judge them in hindsight. Because I remember when Nashville had that long road trip a couple of years ago when they opened their stadium. It was good for them. I've seen on the flip side, this is good for Montreal. They're getting points. Man, it's going to hit good when they get a bunch of home games in the summer. So really, if they can get maybe one more 3 points in the last two road games, they're setting themselves up quite nicely for a midsummer push towards up the table.
And jumping into some quick CPL chatter as well, Ottawa continuing to load up. They've added Aparicio now, and they've got to be among the favorites for the title. It's them or Forge, really.
Yeah, you said they're winning the treble, right?
I see no reason they can't. I mean, with the way they've loaded up, Voyager's Cup seems like it has to be a realistic goal. There's no reason they can't top the regular season and win the playoffs as well.
I mean, they're stacked. Like, every CPL squad has envied Forge previously, and this season Forge has got to be looking at Ottawa thinking like, man, we'd love a couple of those pieces. And in years past, they would have had those pieces, right? They've added not high price, but high profile free agents in years past. And this year, Ottawa collected those guys, which is pretty awesome. I love what they're building. I'm excited for those fans. I really enjoyed going up there when the Fury were playing, and the supporters clubs that have translated over to support Let's Go Ottawa. It's awesome, man. I think Manny Aparicio is a great addition to that team that, like, you know, the year that they won, the year that they lost in the final to Forge and won the regular season, like, they were a Manny Aparicio type of piece away, right? And now they've got Balu Tabla back with something to prove. Matteo Di Brienne, who looks like he's going to be a superstar. He could be an MVP candidate. And Aparicio, who is just this engine. We'll see if he gets red carded in his first game for Atleti. I think that they're off to a good start. It's going to be a good relationship.
I mean, on paper, this has to be the best CPL team we've seen, right? Like, it isn't hyperbole to suggest that, because, like, genuinely, like, again, maybe we'll look like idiots in a few months if Ottawa finishes fourth or fifth or something like that, because that's the CPL. We've seen this before, I guess, in the sense where we've had some teams who we thought were so clearly favorites, they didn't end up being. But, like, genuinely, like, tell me if I'm wrong in any of this. Like, Rayan Yesley was a top three goalkeeper in the league last year. I had him at two in my goalkeeper of the year ballot. You bring him in. Luke Singh, very solid center back last year for Ottawa. You get him back. You know, yeah, they lose Diego Espejo, but Singh, okay, maybe it isn't an Espejo. It still fills those shoes to a decent level, and Singh's still growing. Abubakar Zazoko, he was on any team but Forge. He's one of the best midfielders in the league. And even on that, where with Forge, he was in and out the lineup because they're just so deep in the midfield. He is still one of the best midfielders in the league. Matteo De Brienne, pretty much one of two candidates most people had for best left back in the league last year over at Valor. Balu Tabla, you know, former guy that was in MVP discussions in his lone season in Ottawa. All right, that's someone who you have to imagine has that level to play. You now to add Manny Aparicio into that mix, for me, was at Pacific. He was Pacific. Even when Bustos was, there was that year where Bustos was really killing it. It felt like that team went as Aparicio did. Him and Bustos worked well together, but if Aparicio was in the lineup, they struggled. And that's where someone like that, where he was so much more valuable to his team, that even when he was in the lineup, you clearly didn't feel it. That's scary to add that to an auto. What's been wild in this whole discussion, and it's obviously because we're so focused on the additions, this is still a team that kept Ollie Bassett. They've kept the multiple MVP winner, last year's Golden Boot winner. They've Alberto Zapater is getting a full off season, which I imagine was, you know, those 4 months off were going to do him a world of good at his age. You've got still a solid team at all the other positions. Now, I'm genuinely curious to see what this Ottawa team can do. It's a huge, huge challenge for Carlos Gonzalez, because just ask Bobby Smirnotis. It's not easy to manage a deep roster because everyone wants to play. Everyone wants to start. Everyone wants to be the guy. So you're going to have to manage your rotations very wisely. You're going to have to manage your competition very wisely. Because of all those names I mentioned, at least one or two of them is going to be on the bench to start the year. And they're going to have to accept that and battle and win back their spot. And then also, how is Carlos Gonzalez going to coach this team up from one that has a reputation of just being stingy, but not always being efficient in front of goal? Because, man, they've got guys who can put the ball in the net now. There's no excuse. We've got Sam Salter is there. Well, we didn't mention Kevin DeSantos, who's another signing that I feel like has been so underrated and forgotten. I'm really going to be fascinated to see how Gonzalez handles all this, because if they get that balance right, yeah, on paper, a double is realistic within the CPL, and I'm very curious to see how well they could do in the Canadian Championship. Obviously, until we see otherwise, it's going to be hard to say they can go out and win a CAN champ, because it just seems favored to the level of the MLS teams. They've still all proven, for the most part, this is an MLS team's tournament to lose. But who knows? It would be nice if Ottawa gets an upset on one of them and shows that, yeah, with you get the right talent, you get the right coaching, that is a reality for CPL teams to start dreaming of if they get the recruitment right, as Ottawa seems to have.
Vancouver FC also loading up and potentially adding Nico Giantsopoulos as well. He was on the bench for their 7-0 win over the Fraser Valley Soccer League All-Stars. The FVSL, not the highest level for a preseason match. It's no VMSL, which, Alex, I know you're going to be playing in next year. But a decent look at some new players for Vancouver, and Nico Giantsopoulos, certainly some goalkeeper depth if they do add him as well.
What's going on here? Alex, you're trying out for the CPL?
I'll say context is a very important thing, Ben, as a host. You should know.
purposely left out. Purposely left
out.
Yeah,
man's like VMSL Premier League, the Premier Division All-Stars. Like, yeah, sorry, I'm going to be playing Div 4, Div 3 next year. Like, I'm not going to be going up against Marcel De Jong. Although, hey, if we drew them in the cup, I'd love the chance to go out on the field against them. No, I'm not going to be lining up in Premier next year unless something crazy happens between now and September.
Nico Giantsopoulos, man, York has moved on with two new goalkeepers. He's someone who's got a lot of experience in this league. If he can, I think he can bring a lot to back up Callan Irvin there. And they've got a good thing going in Vancouver, man. Honestly, I love everything about what Afshin Gopi has done and Rob Friend, what they've built out there. I know you don't agree with us, Ben, but you're wrong. Those new kits are phenomenal. I think it's going to be a great season for Vancouver FC, man. Honestly, make it out to Langley.
The latest signing too is one that really it shows the fact they were able to bring Moses Dyer, someone who was very good in the CPL, left the CPL for the USL, and it is willing to come back for a project like Vancouver's is a big sign that of what they're building on top of just this offseason of BC talent, Norman Jr., Fisk. You go across board, the youngster, Grady McDonald, continue to hear great things about what he could bring in year one. Sounds like he's really impressed in preseason with his feistiness and competitive edge despite his age and, of course, his talent. So keep an eye on Grady McDonald. Paris G was one of the best defenders last year. This Vancouver team looks like if they don't make some noise, it's going to, this is a big season for Afshin Gopi because last year, start the year, they spent a lot of time saying, well, we just don't have the roster at the moment. We made some mistakes. Well, they cleared it out. They had a strong end of the year. Build off that because, man, it feels like the season's open for them to make a run into the playoffs because, yeah, Ottawa is expected to be in. Cavalry and Forge, you can't really count out. Halifax looks like a favorite as well for the title. There's five spots in the league now at the very least. And again, on paper, this is a Vancouver team I think I can push for top four now with some of these signings that they've made and the guys they've kept, Kentave, Fry, Garcia, Bitar, I said it last year, this guy, if you give him the right system, he can be an MVP candidate. So keep an eye on him for Bitar. If they're not pushing for top five, because Pacific's rebuilding, Fowler's rebuilding, York's going through new ownership, then you're Vancouver, they're going to have a lot of questions asked because I think so far they've nailed the recruitment and that's setting up for what should hopefully be an exciting season for them out in Langley.
And you go through all those players and, TJ DeHeed is still 16 years old. So it's not just Grady McDonald. There's TJ DeHeed. There's so many young options, but also the recruitment this year has been at another level for Vancouver FC. But that's all we've got for episode 162 of the Northern Football Podcast. For Brendan and Alex, I've been Ben. Thanks so much for tuning in. And just again, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll be back next week.